Welcome to the Bellingcat Monitoring Podcast, where we focus on matters and themes relating to the far right in similar worlds that aren't always discussed in as much depth or detail as they should be. Now, we haven't recorded an episode in about a year, but we're back and we're starting up again. And what better or worse way to start up again than by talking about the far right and white supremacy in the United States? Now, it's of course an election year in the United States, and at the risk of stating the obvious, there's a lot of real serious worry about the direction the country is going in and the threat that all manner of far-right forces pose to American democracy. But these far-right forces in the United States and elsewhere don't just emerge out of a vacuum. And just when we think a particular far-right movement or group is gone or extinct, some new kind of movement or group always seems to emerge. There's this persistence to far-right and white supremacist views in the United States. These individuals, groups, and movements, they always seem to evolve, to adapt, and to spawn new creations that maybe people weren't expecting. But why is this? To answer this question, my Bellingcat Monitoring colleague Kalina Koltai and I spoke with Dr. Kathleen Blee, a sociologist and distinguished professor at the University of Pittsburgh, who spent decades researching both past and contemporary far-right movements in the United States. With Robert Futrell and Pete Simi, she is the co-author of a recent book, Out of Hiding, Extremist White Supremacy and How It Can Be Stopped, published by Routledge earlier in 2024. Thanks, Kathy, for being with us.
Thank you.
So there's this quote that you have here. It says, simply tracking groups and leaders who come and go is a fool's game that's been led to some to conclude that extremist white supremacy is simply too fractured and weak to pose much of a threat to democratic society. So how do we, like Bellingcat journalists, researchers, balance the need to track, monitor, and investigate groups, which we do, against the need to more broadly understand the cultures that sustain far-right ideas? So in other words, how do we not miss the forest for the trees when investigating the far-right?
That's a great question. So that's one of the reasons that my two co-authors, Robert Futrell and Pete Simi, and I wrote this book, Out of Hiding, on extremist white supremacy in the U.S. And one of the arguments that we make about the U.S., but this is pertinent more globally, is that if you look all the way back to the formation of the first Ku Klux Klan after the Civil War, so in the 1870s, there really is quite a persistent organization of extremist white supremacy that always involves sort of core characteristics, white, male, Western domination. And that actually is relatively unchanged over time. But our usual focus, which is groups and networks only, can make it seem as if it's not persistent. So typically, people look at the history of extremist white supremacy in the United States as a set of opportunities or times in which it was there and other times in which it was gone. And what we want to argue is that just because you can't see something, just because you can't see extremism or the global right, far right, doesn't mean it's not there. And the far right globally and in the United States as extremist white supremacy is very adept at going into hiding when that's strategically necessary or useful and emerging into the public sight when that strategic the opportunities are there. So to your question of should we follow groups and networks, certainly, absolutely. Groups and networks are one of the ways in which extremism on the right is organized. They're extremely important. The problem is we don't want to make a conclusion from that is the entirety of the far right, that what we can't monitor doesn't exist, what we can't see, what we can't infiltrate, the people we can't talk to don't exist. I think that's a really dangerous conclusion to make.
So you did just mention, I mean, obviously I know from your work that your focus, and from what you're talking about here, your focus is primarily on the United States, but you did just mention the international context as well. And I know myself personally, I tend to work more in that international context than the American context. What, in your view, I mean, to the extent that you can speak to it, what, in your view, makes the far right different in the United States versus, say, in European countries? I mean, I know that's probably a PhD dissertation of a question, but I'm curious, particularly in the sense of the three key elements that you talk about behind far right culture in your book: practices, ideas, emotions. Is there, like, have you observed any differences in your time?
So one really significant difference is that in Europe and in other parts of the globe, the far right is organized in part or sometimes mostly through parties, through political parties, and that seek electoral office. That's not true in the United States, except for some, you know, very small scale and episodic time. So in the United States, the far right is organized primarily as a social movement. Outside the United States, sort of as a party. Now, like many parts of how we understand the far right, that's really changing, right? So there's much more social movement kind of quality to the far right outside of the U.S., and the extremist right in the United States has really gotten a foothold into the Republican Party. So the distinction that we conventionally make about why is it different in the U.S. and elsewhere is breaking down. So in terms of how we think about, we propose thinking about the far right as a constellation of practices, ideas, and emotions. So that's the practice end. So differently practice, sometimes more similarly practice in the form of electoral parties at other times. The other difference is that typically or traditionally people thought about the far right in the United States as different because it was much more engaged in violence. Sort of violence was not just kind of a goal or sort of an aspiration, but really baked into the practice, the everyday practice of groups in a way that was less common in Europe. So again, you know, that's starting to, you know, break down because European far right groups, you know, have some more of those characteristics of violence. But that still is, I think, a more salient distinction between the two continents.
I think that's really interesting, particularly the bits you pull up about that, just like what are the unique challenges in it and its relationship to political parties. But one thing I find that particularly interesting in the U.S., and I was hoping you could, if what your thoughts are on this, is that, you know, when we think of, you know, white supremacist groups and extreme far right groups, you know, we often think of, like, particularly white men being in those spaces. But I think we've been coming up with more and more examples of people who don't fit that exact model, who are occupying that kind of ideology and filling in those spaces in particular in particular roles. So, like, we can go through a whole list of examples, but, like, you know, there's the example in May of last year, there was the Texas mall shooter. I think recently it was revealed that, like, Stone Toss, the neo-Nazi cartoonist, has Hispanic, I think he has Puerto Rican heritage. And so we're seeing an increasing amount of people who hold sort of white supremacist ideologies and belief, who themselves are not typically, like, white men. Either they're mixed in some capacity or otherwise would be identified as a person of color in the U.S. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about this phenomenon that's happening in the U.S. of people who, of how this white supremacist ideology is, I don't say infecting, except that's not the right word, but how it's spreading into these and being adopted into groups that otherwise would be considered an antithesis to that ideology.
Yeah, that's a great question. So, interestingly enough, in the U.S., that's not new, that phenomena, but claiming it is new, sort of being upfront about it. So people like me who have done work inside, you know, these groups and have talked to people who are activists in white supremacist groups, you know, we've known for a long time that phenomena, there's always been a surprising number of people who are from groups that are basically enemies of these groups who are participants. So, you know, they've always had Jewish members, Black members, et cetera. So that's not new. But what's new now is that now some groups, so Proud Boys are a good example, claim that sort of upfront, sort of even sort of recruit on that as a way of claiming not to be what they are, which is white supremacists. So it's a kind of a new modern way of rebranding. Look, we're not what you think we are. We're not what we are. Because, you know, look, our, you know, leader, Tario, is Hispanic or Latino, whatever he claims to be. So that's, again, kind of a way of hiding. You know, the far right and extremist white supremacy is extremely opportunistic and extremely duplicitous. And so all of this is a part of that. But there's another aspect of that that's interesting, and this is true in the U.S., in Europe, other places. There's much more kind of intermingling of ideological intermingling now than was the case in the past. So, you know, the anti-vax rallies in Europe and the U.S. were really an example of that. So you have people who are really, you know, hardcore dedicated white supremacists, paramilitary and stuff, who are sort of involved with people who are anti-vax or anti-shutdown for other kinds of reasons. And you have a little bit of ideological blurring, which gave the far right a wonderful, from their perspective, opportunity to pull in and recruit and, you know, bring their ideological ideas to new sets of people.
I actually think it's so interesting that you bring up the anti-vax bit. That's a lot of where I spent mm-hmm. my time studying, and I could talk probably mm-hmm. for ages on the vaccine movement.
I thought the same thing when she mentioned it, Colina, like, oh, Colina will have something to say, so I'll just mute my mic.
I mean, if you think about Canada, you know, the big trucker protest in Canada. So, you know, then you have people who are, I mean, basically truck drivers who, you know, are worried about their livelihood. But then you have, and then you have people who are against vaccination because they're health purists. And then you have, you know, people with all kinds of Nazi, you know, not only ideas, but symbolism all over their trucks. And yet that coalesces into some, we would say, constellation of practice in which people don't pull apart on those bases, right? I mean, those seem antithetical. You have people who come out of sort of a progressive eco view or environmental view, health view, and you have people who are really diehard anti-Semites finding the ability to sort of practice together, express emotion, you know, build on the same emotions. That's a really scary phenomena.
Yeah, and you know, this reminds me of even though the answer that you brought up earlier when we're asking about, you know, testing these groups and how you mentioned how they were like hidden and they'll like kind of rise and like bubble up at certain points throughout history. And it's almost kind of like it's always hidden within plain sight. I feel like, you know, it's always there. It just depends on how much we're like aware of it happening. And I find this like, this became, I think a particularly interesting thread, really, you know, erupting obviously in the pandemic where we saw a lot of overlap in different communities in different spaces, as we get to talk about like far right, conspiratorial, anti-lockdown, you know, and even like particularly when I think of like lefty spaces, like the granola, crunchy mob, holistic, flowing into those spaces. And it I recall back to several anti-vax conferences and events I've gone to, and actually how what I thought was interesting as a newbie researcher at the time, like in 2015, 2016, was that there was so much talk about eugenics in those spaces, and that how vaccines are part of this eugenics and bringing this in. And you wouldn't have thought about it in that space, but I think it harkens to the idea that there is sort of this hidden or like this lower level of ideology and race, even in these groups. And that's how I think there was such overlap and sort of you saw these groups commingling and coalescing at this time. And I wonder if you see that a lot in the work that you do, and that you might see a space or an ideology that may not necessarily be on the surface immediately thinking it being rooted in white supremacy, and then yet it's actually there. Like we saw in the anti-vax space, we don't think of it as being like a white supremacist type of like ideology, but there are so many undercurrents there. Do you see that in like other spaces as well? Give you the tough questions.
So one of the spaces which I mentioned before it's related is environmentalism, and that is a scary phenomena. But even in the 1990s, when I was interviewing people, they were talking about trying to recruit from environmentalists. I was interviewing white supremacists, and they saw that as a fertile field, which seemed at the time really a stretch. But you know, that wasn't a stretch, and they really made that argument about sort of purity and that sort of underlying thing, right? Environmental purity, racial purity, that's been quite, alarmingly successful in bringing people, if not into the white supremacist movement, into those ideas and conversant with a lot of ideas. And in particular, it's a way of introducing people into a kind of conspiratorialism that's really key to far-right ideology, certainly in the U.S., but in a lot of other places as well. So, you know, introducing the kind of strong dichotomy of us and them, and then a conspiratorial overlay to that's a very small step to, for example, you know, really a deep kind of anti-Semitism that comes to be very prominent in those kinds of environmental far-right dialogues or intermixings.
When I was reading your book, one of the things that jumped out at me right away, because it does dovetail with my own thinking on this, so that's why I'm asking, is how fundamental the role of emotion is to the far-right. And I think a lot of people, when they think about the far right or people becoming radicalized or joining the far right, that they do it out of some emotionless, rational calculation, or that it's actually about ideology and not these other emotional factors that you talk about. But one of the obvious differences between, you know, 2024 and say, I guess 1994, is the role of the internet and social media in all of our lives, including the far right, obviously. And I think there's a growing understanding, and if not a growing amount of research suggesting that social media has, you know, a particular role to play, an unfortunate role to play, but in the way that it can provoke and sustain and even amplify a lot of the emotions that we have. I mean, I think just any of us can click over to X/Twitter right now and see that in action. Now, unlike myself, you know, you've been researching the far right since at least around the beginnings of the internet, but certainly before social media. Is there something different now about the way that emotions underpin far-right ideas, or are we still kind of figuring that out?
So let me give a scholar's answer, yes and no. So
I like that answer.
Let me start with the no part, because maybe that's a more surprising part. So the first far right movement that I studied was the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s. And I looked at the organization of women in the Klan. So that Klan was enormous. I mean, far bigger than any far right movement in the U.S. since. So it had maybe 3-5 million members, given that you had to be white, native born, and Protestant. It was a huge percentage of the eligible population. So it was just a massive movement. Now, obviously, that's 1920s, just long before the internet. But one of the things I did is I interviewed women who had been in the Klan. I did this in the 80s. They were very elderly and had been in the Klan early in their life. But one of the things that was really clear is that they, even so many decades later, they recalled emotions as really a key to what brought them in and what made them connected to the Klan and what made them feel part of the Klan. And sort of trying to probe how that worked, it was clear that, you know, they didn't have the internet. They had very limited communications. A lot of these people lived in rural areas, small towns. But what the Klan was able to do is put together a cultural vehicle that was incredibly powerful. So they would come to town or come to your county area with, you know, airplanes dropping, you know, candy out of the sky and big tents with supposed ex-nuns talking about the sexual violations they'd experienced by priests. The Klan was very anti-Catholic. They had, you know, all kinds of festivals and Klan baby naming and Klan ceremonies. So culture was a very powerful glue that pulled people together and brought, you know, these very extremist ideas and agendas to people who were, you know, literally quite ordinary. In fact, some of them actually fairly progressive. A lot of women who had been in the women's suffrage movement became active in that Klan. Okay, so now moving to today, we have a different kind of glue, which is that we have the internet, which can tie people together, but maybe more importantly, creates a vehicle for the spread of a culture, a way, sort of an understanding and emotions that can pull people in and make them feel a part of something. So when we talk to people today who are join extremist groups, very few people ever say, I joined or I got involved because I was reading about these ideas and I was really compelled by the ideas and I went out and, you know, acted on it by joining a group. They talk about their connection to somebody, sort of an emotional connection. I found with this group of people I really liked. They were really nice and, you know, they made me feel good. And, you know, so it's kind of a cultural, emotional connection that pulls people in and that brings people together. And that is magnified and held together and accelerated by social media. But, you know, I don't think we want to say that social media, like, causes it. Like, all of those other factors are in play. But social media has obviously been an incredibly powerful vehicle for the far right.
But it hasn't fundamentally changed the nature, the underlying nature of the emotions and the culture around it, is what you're saying.
Except I would say the pace of emotional change is much faster. Mm-hmm. So if you look at any conversation on social media, but certainly conversations among that involve extremists, the pace in which things become much more and more extreme is accelerated on the internet in a way that you wouldn't see with people just sitting around in a room.
Right. I've been in enough of these digital far right spaces to know this. And I'm sure, I know Kalina has been as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because we even talk about on a large scale, like how lonely and how isolated people are feeling, even like particularly, and not just in one like demographic necessarily, like this happens across multiple age groups, and how in theory, social media is supposed to be a tool that can connect us. In a lot of ways, it does connect us, but it also can make it feel isolating. So even that playing a role in this. But I want to ask a follow-up question, only because you did bring up about women in these far-right spaces and how there's been this change and how they're actually part of the social glue, right? There is a big social and communal and community aspect. And, you know, that plays into like maybe the isolation feel. And so you come and so you meet people in this group in these spaces. And women occupying a lot of that and oftentimes left out of this conversation. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about like modern women who are still in, like who are in this far right space, and particularly interesting because there is a lot of like overlap in relationship to like misogyny within these far right spaces. And so I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about how, you know, given that, you know, there's been, you know, greater rights and like, you know, women having rights and not just voting and independence, and there is a lot of work that's happened in the progressiveness of women within the U.S., but there is still a very critical role that women play within these far-right spaces, even being a leader within the far-right space. So I was wondering, that's like a very big overarching question, and I know there's a whole book dedicated if you want to like read Women of the Far-Right, but I was wondering if I can get your two cents on that.
Sure. So going back to the idea that far right is opportunistic, this is really true in terms of gender issues as a whole. So on the one hand, far right, certainly in the U.S., elsewhere, is highly misogynistic. I mean, that's sort of a core issue and highly masculinist in its practices, too. At the same time, there often are messages that go out to women about how women can be kind of racial warriors or, you know, stand up for their kids and race and all that kind of stuff. So there's sort of a contradictory appeal to women. Women do move into these groups and networks, you know, all across the world, almost never as an official leader. I mean, there clearly are exceptions, and the number of exceptions is increasing, but it's still quite rare to have any woman with the title of leader. On the other hand, I would argue that women play a lot of leadership roles in those groups, and overlooking women has overlooked a lot of what causes those groups to hang together or those networks to hang together, that, you know, depending on the time period and the kind of group, women often, you know, do the recruiting or organize recruiting, do the sort of internal solidarity building and repair of relationships that keeps these groups together, do the interface with public that can make these groups look less extreme or less violent or less dangerous than they are. So women play some really serious leadership roles, but the fact that women are rarely looked at, not only by scholars, but by law enforcement, means that they overlook a lot of what goes on in those groups and what allows them to be persistent over time. At the same time, I should say, women who I've interviewed in these groups, and I've interviewed many, many women, rarely have anything positive to say about their experience. Unlike men, who often have positive things, you know, feel like, you know, they benefited a lot and, you know, they became really adept at things and they got a lot of praise and glory. Women who, even those playing really critical roles, can feel quite trapped in those, unable to leave, and quite abused. So it's a very complicated picture of women in the far right.
Right. I mean, and a lot of times, even though a core tenet of a lot of like white supremacist groups and movements is the having more white babies, right? So like you can't do that without a woman. So it's interesting that it's women occupy this very, in a sense, a critical component, because if you think about the idea of like needing to create, you know, more white children, you're securing the future for a white race, all of that, like women are essential to that, but never seen as Women aren't given they're treated as objects so much, so strongly in this movie, even though they provide such an important bit of the social glue of those spaces. And so it's just this really interesting bit about that.
I should say this is true as well if you look in online spaces. So there's, you know, women far-right influencers and sort of media figures out there. So on the one hand, that seems to be sort of a new, like, place of visibility for women in the far right. On the other hand, you know, a lot of those women have experienced extreme amount of misogynist hatred and harassment, not necessarily from people who are opposed to the far right, but from their so-called male comrades as well. So, you know, that double-edged position that women occupy in the far right is true offline and online.
So one of the things that I notice you do discuss in the book, especially I think in the final chapter, you talk about the role of law enforcement in combating the far right. And in your discussion in the book, you push back against the idea of there needing to be new laws for domestic terrorism and like new domestic terror laws in the US context. However, my sense is that, especially from doing research and investigations on the so-called active club phenomenon, there really does seem to be a push from some actors for domestic terror legislation that could be ostensibly used to go after some of these far-right groups. And I think also a desire to, under that, to name specific groups or networks, transnational or not, name them as designated terror organizations. Like, for example, Blood and Honor is in my native Canada since 2019. But you, if I can quote from the book here, or shorten the quote a little bit, you say, but rather than creating new laws to address domestic terrorism, we see greater efficacy in applying existing laws that already provide the government with tools to respond to domestic terrorism. How would you see going forward, especially in the American context, the role of law enforcement in pushing back against the far right?
Yeah, thank you. So I should say one of the reasons that it's very difficult to imagine an effective domestic terrorism statute for the far right in the U.S. is that the commitment to free speech is so strong in the United States in law that it would likely be entangled for a long time. And secondarily, any statute that one could create that would get around that would likely be a vehicle that would be very useful for going after the left. So it's very hard in the U.S. legal context to craft something that wouldn't have that double-edged quality to it. I'm sorry, would you repeat your question?
I know the feeling. How should law enforcement in the United States focus on, like, what can or should law enforcement do versus perhaps, in your opinion, what shouldn't they do or be doing or want to do?
So two things. One is law enforcement is one of the audiences that this book is directed at, in the sense that in the law enforcement way of understanding, if you can't see a group, if it's not walking down the street, it doesn't exist, right? So they're very only focused on what's visible. They're do very little anymore surveillance or anything of sort of less visible kinds of far-right activity. But secondarily, there is a very surprisingly low level of criminal prosecution of far-right actors who have committed violence. So, you know, the classic story is the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, you know, where hundreds of paramilitary and far-right extremists from across the country came armed and descended on this little college town in Virginia and, you know, created mayhem. one person was killed, but many, many people were injured as well. There was virtually no prosecution except of the person who drove the car who killed the woman of what happened in Charlottesville that day. You know, there was a civil prosecution that was brought by plaintiffs who were injured, but that was because there was no criminal prosecution. So we have the statutes. There's a conspiracy statute in the United States that's been used very effectively for all kinds of actors who commit crimes and involved in criminal conspiracies that could be used against far-right actors, but for reasons that one would imagine are largely political, it rarely is.
Right. One of the far-right figures that I personally have written a few times about in the American context is Robert Rundo, who founded the Rise Above movement. And your response is making me think about, you know, something I've said to other people about Rundo's whole situation, where he was, you know, indicted on these charges under the Federal Anti-Rioting Act. And of course, there's been a huge, been a long legal mess, especially recently with him. But I always found it weird that, like, why, you know, I can only express it pretty informally. It's like, why are you going after him him and his comrades with this kind of arcane go around way of federal anti-rioting? Like, he's on video punching people. Like, why is there, that's why I actually do have doubts whether he'll end up getting convicted. But it does, what you're saying makes, it certainly, of course, as you well know, doesn't just apply to the U.S. I think in Germany, I know there are a lot of people particularly concerned, if not angry, about far-right actors in that country who, you know, I think my understanding is there's, you know, several hundred far-right extremists in Germany with active warrants out for their arrest. Well, maybe police should try to find some of them. What I'm getting at is it seems like the tools from a law enforcement and legal perspective in almost every country, they do seem to be there, but it's a matter of like political or legal prosecutorial willpower to actually do anything about it.
Yeah. And we're really concerned with the mainstreaming of extremism in the United States. So this is not just a phrase, you know, the penetration of extremist ideas, you know, persons, practices all across the U.S. political landscape is quite pronounced. And that in itself makes enforcement very difficult, but also makes handing a new domestic terrorism law to a political establishment that is increasingly dominated by extremists in the Republican Party a very dangerous scenario.
Yeah, definitely.
This reminds me of how we were able to get Al Capone for tax evasion.
Right. Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's interesting that, you know, we mentioned the Unite the Right rally. We've talked a little bit about social media, and this has gotten me thinking a bit because, you know, a lot of the way these spaces operate, that we need to think about digital spaces, but we also think about physical spaces. You know, there is this idea of like the areas in which the people in these movements and these groups occupy, that there are people who transition into these communities through these very like online spaces, through social media. But there's also this very big, obviously, like physical component, you know, from, we talk about active clubs, people meeting up in person, doing events. You know, Patriot Front does meetup events where they go and like do some sort of activity together. And having some sort of like space, either their own place or some sort of safe space, it's pretty key for the far right. Now, if you can talk a little bit about the spaces in which they occupy.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, we can be sort of blinded by the importance of the internet and social media in the far right and lose track of the fact that even today with, you know, the internet and social media so powerful, physical spaces are really not essential, but extremely helpful to the advancement of far-right agendas. So there are certainly far-right groups that and communities that operate completely online. There are certainly violence has come out of, you know, mass violence has come out of situations in which people really didn't have connections outside of their internet communities. But in terms of the building the movement and the strength of the movement and the persistence of the movement, those spaces that can be, you know, as you mentioned, clubs and, you know, music concerts, but increasingly can be rallies, sort of that your rally or somebody else's rally that you're sort of opportunistically glomming onto, like the anti-vaccination rallies, are really important. I mean, it shows that sort of the personal connection, sort of the in-life emotional connections that people get out of physical spaces is really important to keeping people interested, keeping people tied, making people think that what's going on is plausible and, you know, reasonable. So I think it's really important, this kind of the focus you're talking about, focusing on the, you know, the active clubs and everything that actually occupy spaces, not just for their own acceleration, but for, you know, their ability to pull people in from surrounding scenes into those spaces.
Yeah, I think that is like a major component of this. I mean, you know, it translates. I think that's part of the power is that the space that, or the way that they occupy, the way that they form community, and the way that they empower people within those organizations to like want to stay within that organization is through those physical spaces, and we see that erupt in sometimes really catastrophic ways.
Yeah, and I think we see from our work at Bellingcat how mad these guys get when we do something to undermine the sanctity of that space, like geolocating a fight night, or, you know, that the kinds of things that we do. So I think we know how important space is to the far right, because whether they intend to or not, they like to let us know after our articles.
Indeed. Yeah.
So I don't think we have any more questions for you. Is there anything else that you wanted to add with the time that we've got?
I just want to thank you for the great work that you do. Do is such a service to the community worldwide, and we really, really appreciate all the work and effort that goes into that work.
That's really nice to hear. All right. Well, Kathleen Bully, thanks very much for taking the time to chat with us today. And that's all from us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Bellingcat Monitoring Podcast. If you want to keep up with what the far right is up to around the world, make sure to check out the monitoring team's latest investigations on our website, bellingcat.com. The Bellingcat Monitoring Podcast is produced by Michael Colburn and Charlotte Marr for Stitch Ting Bellingcat. The music you've heard is called Lie by Daisy Chain and is courtesy of Artlist.